Thank you very much, Rabbi Rothman. And I want to thank the Kaufman family for sponsoring the breakfast. The memory of Avram Ben Nissan. Len's been a good friend pretty much since I arrived in Toronto. When he would come to the Beis Medrash, he would learn with his chavrusa, with the Talmud Javaski. And it's certainly an honor for me to be able to give this class this morning in his memory. The question of the Jews' presence in Esav's world, in the non-Jewish world, has changed over the past few decades. When you go back to the 60s in Vatican II, in which the Catholic Church re-envisions the relationship between Christians and Jews, and then you have, in more modern times, an embrace of the State of Israel by certain groups within what are usually called in the States Protestants. I'm not entirely clear on the terms here in Canada. And then you have a rise in Muslim fundamentalism, which has made Christians in general look, frankly, a little more attractive to Jews. The combination of these events has put Jewish-Christian relations, I wrote Jewish, non-Jewish in the title, but really it's Jewish-Christian relations, I think in a different light. More today than any time in the last, basically, 1800 years, there may be a country or two which are exceptions, but more today than any time in Jewish memory, there are groups of Christians who approach Jews from the perspective of friendship. And the question for the Jew is, how do I respond to those overtures? What am I supposed to do? What's my relationship supposed to be when my relationship is with people who don't believe what I believe in, whose core beliefs, in fact, deny what I believe in? How am I supposed to relate to them in the greater world, adding in the emotional baggage of 2,000 years, pretty much, of persecution in so many different countries? Name a country in Europe, and we were kicked out of it at least once. When you're talking about inquisitions, when you're talking about crusades, when you're talking about Khmelnytsky massacres in the middle of the 17th century, whether you're talking about pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia, Jews have had a very hard time at their hands. And then part of the question is not just theological, how do I relate to people who don't believe what I believe in, but how do I relate to people whose ancestors killed my ancestors? These are very hard questions to address. And I called this year, the title that was on the flyers, was When Esav Met Yaakov, a Jew in a non-Jewish world, because even though when you think about the biblical account, it sounds more like Yaakov meeting Esav, as we'll see in the story itself, Esav today meets Yaakov. Esav today, in many parts of the Western world, is coming to meet Yaakov. And the question is, how does Yaakov respond? If you take a look at source number one, this is a passage of Medrash that goes back to the encounter we're going to discuss between our ancestor Yaakov and his brother Esav. Remember the biblical story. Yitzchak and Rivka have two sons. Their names are Yaakov and Esav. They are twins. Yaakov, through machinations that are beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss this morning, receives a blessing that Esav believes was meant for him. Esav is angry. He says, I want to kill Yaakov. Yaakov runs away. He goes to the house of Lavan, his relative. He stays there for 20 years. He marries four women. He has there 11 sons and a daughter. And then he comes back. He leaves Lavan's home. And on his way back, he sends messengers to go find Esav, and that brings us to the story that we're going to be discussing this morning. But as part of their encounter, at the end of the encounter, this is sort of blowing the ending, you're not really supposed to do that. But at the end of the encounter, Esav says to Yaakov, I want to go with you. After whatever happens during their meeting, Esav says, I want to go with you. I want to be with you. And Yaakov says, no, thank you. I appreciate it. It's a nice offer. But you go your way. I'll go mine. We'll meet up eventually. And we'll see more about that in a few minutes. But take a look, please, at source number one. A classic rabbinic account. based on that line. Source 1. Vayomer lo Esav, and Esav said to Yaakov, Atziga na imcha, I will go forth with you. Bikesh lilavoso, velo kibel alav. He, Esav, wished to escort Yaakov, and Yaakov did not accept. That's the biblical account, and now we get the story that follows from there. Rabbeinu, the author of the Medrash, says, when our master, possibly referring to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was very close with the Roman authorities, so when he wished to go to the government, when he would go to Rome, Karavasalik Lamalchusa, for those following in the Hebrew, Hava Mistakel Bahada Parshasa, Velo Hava Nasiv Aramaa Imei. When our master, probably Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, this leader, would go to Rome to meet with the government, as he would from time to time on communal matters, he would study this portion, the story of Yaakov and Esav, and their meeting. And as a result of his study, he wouldn't take an Aramean with him. Aramean is meant to refer to someone who wasn't Jewish. So he would not take anybody with him. Why not? Because just as his ancestor Yaakov did not want to travel with Esav, he said, I don't trust the descendants of Esav, I don't want to have someone with me. However, Chadzman lo istakalba, once he didn't study it. What happened? The Nasav Imei Romain, or Aramain, depending on your edition, he took Arameans with him. He didn't reach Akko, which is the port. He didn't even get to the port before he had sold out his horse from under him. In other words, what happened was, he ends up being less cautious because he forgets the lessons of the story. How he forgot by not studying it once is a really good question. The mechanics of this are a little bit confusing to me. Did he simply forget what he had known all along? I don't know. But at one point, he forgot the lessons of the story, and he, in fact, was escorted by people who were these Arameans, Romans, whatever they were. And before he even reaches the port of Akko, they have sold out his horse. He sold his horse. They convinced him to sell his horse out from under himself. In other words, he got cheated along the way. What message comes to us from this source? What kind of an approach do we see here? Sorry? Non-trust, right? There's a lack of trust. The approach of Rabbeinu, our master, here in this, as learned from Yaakov, is, I don't trust these outsiders. And we get the story to confirm non-trust, right? That's what's being said here. Now, remember... Well, that's also true, that the Jew is gullible. that he could be so easily cheated out of his horse. This is true. Remember the world that he lives in. He lives in a world in which the Jews are basically crushed by the Roman Empire. Rabbeinu, we're talking about the beginning of the 3rd century. End of the 2nd century, beginning of the 3rd century. And the Jews have had the temple destroyed by the Romans in the year 68, the year 70. Numerous rebellions afterwards were put down, most famously in the year 135, the Beit HaVeis revolt. Jews are massacred in the thousands and tens of thousands when the revolt was crushed. The Jews are suffering terribly under the Romans. So that, I think, today, it's something that's hard for us to relate to. In other words, if I read this story from 21st century eyes, and I know that I have a neighbor who's not Jewish, and that neighbor never tried to steal my horse, and never treated me miserably, and so on, it's hard for me to relate to this. I grew up in a non-Jewish world, in a Christian world, in fact. Never had anybody try that. I was gullible. But it never had anybody try to cheat me. So it's a little bit hard to relate to what's being described here. But looking at it in the framework of this Medrash, they're telling us that the Jew has to be suspicious and that it's learned from Yaakov. That's what we see right here. The question is, what about our world? Right, going back to my point from the beginning, we're not living in a world of Roman persecution. We're not living in any number of governments down through history. Every time I go to an event here in Toronto at which there is, you know, any sort of political element. Maybe there's a speaker from the Canadian government or whatever it is. The surest way to get a standing ovation from the crowd is to mention Stephen Harper. Right? Is that not true? There we go. The surest, and not without reason. Right? We know what he's done. We know that he's the best friend Israel has around the world. It's not like, it's not for nothing. But my point is, when I'm not living in a world in which the Romans are crushing the Jews, but in fact I'm living in a world in which Esav is coming to our door, what changes? What stays the same?
Rabbi, would you not consider that where we live today, Yotzei Dofen, that it is an anomaly?
Could be.
Because in other parts of the world, the Jew still is oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
They still live in fear. And we don't have to look that far. We just have to look to Western Europe. And we see today, mm-hmm. the Jew is still under the eye of the ones who don't want to receive him.
Right. And so that's why I make the point that I agree with you very much. That's why I make the point. I'm talking about within this society, within a world in which Esav comes to meet Yaakov. Not a world in which you're dealing with overt hostility. Yeah, the Menachem Begin had a term that he used. He talked about normal exiles and abnormal exiles. It wasn't his own term. He was borrowing it from someone else. I forget who he had gotten it from. But the normal exile is the world in which, as he put it, it's like this. The world in which the greater fear for the Jew is that he's going to assimilate out, as opposed to that somebody's going to come along to abuse him.
15 years ago, when I first came to Toronto, the person that I was coming to stay with when I first emigrated said to me, the trouble with the Goyim here is they're so goddamn nice.
Interesting. Interesting.
It kind of summarizes the...
That's an interesting one. The question fundamentally is, how does the Jew relate to this Esav who is, I'm going to change the wording a little bit, who is so nice?
The Esav, my brother.
What is he? Yeah, but the Esav who is my brother indeed. So with this question in mind, take a look please at source number 2. This is the account of the meeting between Yaakov and Esav. It follows on, as I said, Yaakov's return to Israel with his family in tow. Yaakov has already sent messengers to find Esav. He has heard that Esav has 400 men, which has a military connotation to it. Esav is coming to greet you with 400 men. We presume that's not a welcome party. We presume that Esav is still angry because 20 years ago you stole what he believed to be his blessing. He said, I'm going to kill you. Maybe he hasn't forgotten that in 20 years. So Yaakov is concerned and he takes several steps. He splits up his camp into two groups, saying, this way, if one camp is attacked, the other one will be able to flee. He turns to God and he prays to be saved from Esav. And he sends a huge gift. A massive gift. The Torah describes different sets of animals. It's a massive gift that he sends to his brother Esav. Then, there's an encounter with some kind of being in the middle of the night. A wrestling match. The rabbis explain that this is a representative of Esav. And he's wrestling with Yaakov. And Yaakov ultimately survives it. He is wounded on his leg, but he is considered to be the victor coming out of it. He emerges strengthened. He emerges encouraged, we are told. He gets a blessing from this angel. He gains a new name, Yisrael. Israel. The sun rises. He is healed from his wounds. And then we get source number 2. Vayisa Yaakov Einav. Yaakov raised his eyes. Vayar vihine Esav ba. And he sees Esav is coming. The imo are bameos ish, and there are the 400 men. Vayachat es hayiladim al Leah ve'al Rachel v'al shtei ashefachos. He divides up the children to Leah, one of the mothers, Rachel, another of the mothers, and then the two maids who were mothers of several, four of the children as well. Vayosem es hashefachos ve'az yaldayen rishona. First he has the maids and their kids. Ves Leah v'iladeha acharonim. Then Leah and her kids after them. Ves Rachel ve'az Yosef acharonim. And Rachel and Yosef, her only son, last. And v'hu avar lifnehem. And Yaakov goes in front of the entire group. He bowed to the ground 7 times before reaching his brother. Okay. Comments on that first, the opening 3 verses? I see a lot going on here, yes. Yeah. Yeah. What happened to the 2 camps? Now suddenly they're all together. Unless you're going to tell me that Yaakov and family are in the first camp and hangers-on are in the second camp, and the first camp that goes first is all the people he really cares about, right? His wives and his children are all going to be in the first camp, and they're the ones who are going to get slaughtered so that the second camp can flee. That doesn't make any sense. It appears that Yaakov has abandoned his idea of 2 camps. Good. Yes?
We could not consider that the ones that he sent ahead with the gifts as the first camp.
Mm.
And because he sent, and they were separated between them. He sent different messengers with each set of the animals. And Esav responds to him when after they meet. They say, he says, "And what were all those things that I saw come before me?"
Right, that's how we're getting to that.
In his first camp.
Uh-huh. It's an interesting idea. So the gift was actually the first camp. I haven't seen that suggested. I wonder how it fits into the words, though. Because I think in the words, if I remember correctly, first what happens is he sends the gift, and then he says, "I'm going to split the camp in half."
But chronologically, he's...
Right, I hear what you're saying. It's an interesting idea.
He's going over in his head how he's going to do it.
Right.
But physically, how it accomplished it.
Right, it could be. I'm not so sure, but I hear what you're suggesting.
He shows a sophistication in terms of his understanding of the potential duplicity of his brother.
Yeah.
So he's maybe playing a game of double jeopardy. I'm going to send them first. He knows that I'm going to send somebody first, and he won't realize that I'm sending the most valuable people first, and therefore they'll be safer than the people who are going to follow, who he's going to deem to be more valuable to me.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting trick. Could be. Maybe he's worried about an ambush from behind. I don't know. Sheldon.
It seems that after the encounter with the angel or whatever, his plans have changed. It could be, based on some other readings, that he decided to stand his ground.
That he's decided to stand his ground. He is now newly encouraged from his encounter with the angels, with the angel as being in the night, and now he's going to stand his ground and be firm and actually face Esav like a man, so to speak. The only problem I have with that is in sentence 3. Right, in sentence 3, where it says he bowed 7 times, is that what you call, standing firm? It's bowing firm? I don't know. Yes? Right, but now they're all together.
Where does it say they're together?
Because, you'll see as the verses continue. You'll see as they continue. They really are. I think they are together. Yeah. Right, but I think the notion... Right, but the notion that one could flee when the other one was attacked, I don't think works if they're as close together as they're going to seem to be as we read the story. Right, so why say that they're actually... Why actually do that is a good question. Hang on to that. Hang on to that thought. I'm going to take one more, because otherwise we're not going to be able to go further with it. The hand was up there first. I'll tell you what, though. I will take that opportunity to say, please make sure to sign in with your email address, because I'm going to want to follow up after this year on some of the questions that I may not get to. So there are sheets on some of the tables. This is not a solicitation list. It's not going to be used for anything like that. I just need to... You're not going to get endless email as a result. I just want to be able to follow up after the talk on questions that don't get addressed. Yes?
He set up layers and then his wives, and then in his own behavior he sets up what I would call a pseudo-mutual relationship with Esau. He pretends to be agreeable to agreeable. So he's setting up layers of protection.
Right. And I think that's very much there. I think that's very much there. The idea that he is setting up layers of protection and making himself look amiable, making himself look like everything is okay, and he's not really prepared for battle and for flight and so on. I definitely hear it, and we'll see how that plays out. I'm sorry not to take every comment. I just there are some things we do need to get to, and there's so much more to read. If you take a look on the sheet at Pasuk Dal, at sentence 4, Vayaratz Esav Likraso Vayechabkehu. So after these 7 bows, Esav runs forward to Yaakov, and he hugs him. Vayipol al tzavarav vayishakehu. He fell on his neck, and he kissed him. The pronouns are a little bit vague, but it seems that Esav falls on Yaakov's neck, and he kisses him. Vayivku, and they cried. Vayisa es einav, sentence 5, he raised his eyes. Vayaris hanoshim ves hayiladim. Esav raised his eyes, he saw all the women, he saw all the children. Vayomer mi elalach. And he said, who are all of these for you? Who are these to you? Remember, when he left, Yaakov was single. He's been busy. The Vayomar hayiladim asher chanan elokim es avdecha. And Yaakov responds, these are the children God has graciously given to your servant. He doesn't say to me. He says, these are the children God has given to your servant. Interesting. That, to me, that doesn't ring of standing firm. Maybe it's this false amiability, but it's for sure not standing firm. So what happens? So pasuk vav, sentence 6. Vatigashna hashefachos, heina v'yaldehen, vatishtachavena. The maids go forth with their kids, and they bow. Vatigash gam le'avila deha, and Leah and her kids, they go forward. Vayishtachavu, and they bow. Ve'achar nigash Yosef v'Rachel vayishtachavu, and then Rachel and Yosef go forward, and they bow. The commentators note the reversal here. For all the other ones, it says the mother first, and then the child, but here it's Yosef, and then Rachel, and they suggest Yosef wants to protect his mother from Esav. An interesting side note. But everybody bows to Esav. Vayomer, sentence 8. And he said, Milacha kol hamachaneh hazeh asher pagashti, Esav says to Yaakov. What is all this? What's this whole camp that I encountered? By which he means the gift. The gift that was sent. He says, what's this gift all about? Vayomer lim sochein b'nei Adoni. To which Yaakov responds, to find favor in the eyes of my master. Vayomer Esav yeshli rav. Esav says, "What? I don't need all this. I have a lot. Achi, my brother, yehilacha asher lach. You have what's yours. I don't need your property. I have my own property." Vayomer Yaakov, and Yaakov says, "No. I'll not. No, no, no. Please," he says. "Im na matzasi chen beinecha. If I have found favor in your eyes, v'lakachta min chasi miyadi. Take my gift from my hand." He says, seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. At this point, it's a little over the top. Seeing your face is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. You have been satisfied with me. That is really a very strong way to put this, so strong that some of the rabbis in the Medrash actually take it as a threat rather than a compliment. And he says, you know, Esav, I deal with God. Or, alternatively, I fought with an angel last night, you know. I'm familiar with that. And therefore, don't mess with me. But taking it on a very straightforward, very very literal level, Yaakov is saying to Esav, I need you to accept this gift. I am so awed by being in your presence. And he continues, sentence 11, he's not done. Kach na'es bircha si asher huvas lach. Take my blessing. Bracha is used not only for a blessing, but also used for an offering. In the prophet Malachi, in the second chapter, also, it talks about our karbanot, our offerings to God, as our brachot, our blessings. So he says, take my offering, asher huvas lach, that has been brought to you. Ki chanani elokim v'chiyesh li kol, because God's given me a lot. I have everything I could ever need. Vayivtzarbo, and he pushed him, because this is the Middle East and nothing gets done without pushing. And he pushed him. Vayikach, and he took it. Finally, Esav says, "All right, you forced me. I'll take all the camels. I'll take everything. You know, that's the way you want it. That's the way it'll be."
Isn't this the sign to be equal?
Sorry?
Isn't this the sign that Jacob wanted to be equal? equal to Isaac?
What do you mean?
By accepting, but not accepting all the gifts that he gave it to him, and he insisted that he should take it as a sign of that he's equal to him.
Right. So one way to look at it, I think, is that it does establish a certain equality, where we are peers and you accept my gift. On the other hand, you could also look at it as tribute.
The tribute was as an appeasement.
Right. You could look at it as tribute from a defeated party to the conqueror. I'm not sure.
If we consider their basic nature, Jacob was spiritual, Esav was materialistic, and he was of the earth. The original crime that Jacob did to Esav was to steal his birthright. Here he is, he's saying, here's all the wealth that you could desire. Surely this has got to be worth more than what I stole from you. Please take this and let's forget that it ever happened.
Right, so there are some who indeed look at it that way or put a slightly different spin on it and say, what he's saying is, what Esav is saying to, in response is, I've done just fine without the bracha, without the blessing. I don't need what you're going to offer me. So there is that way to look at it for sure. Well, let's see what happens now in sentence 12. Vayomer nis'av ne'elecha ve'elchal ne'gdecha. Esav says, let's travel together. I am going to travel in parallel with you. Yud Gimel, sentence 13. Vayomer elav. And Yaakov says back to him, Adoni yodea ki hayeladim rakim. You know, the kids are soft. Vatzon v'abakar alos alai. And I'm responsible for these sheep and their nursing. Udvakum yom echad v'meisu kalatzon. If I'm going to push them for even a day, all the sheep are going to die. We can't take the pace. We can't do it. Yabar na adoni lifnei avdo. Let my master, once again, go in front of his servant. Vanias nahala le'iti. I'll go at my own pace. L'regel hamalacha shelefanai, based on the work I have before me. U'l'regel hayiladim, and along with these kids at their pace. Ad asher avo el adoni se'ira, until I come to my master to se'ir. Vayomer Esav, and Esav said, he says, I get it. I understand. You can't keep up with my people. I get the problem. No worries. I'm going to leave my people and come join you, Esav says to Yaakov. You can't get a more generous offer than that, right? I'm going to abandon everything I have, all of my friends, all of that, and I'm going to be, instead, one with Yaakov. I'll join Yaakov's camp. That's Esav's offer. Vayomer, and Yaakov responds, Lama ze'em tzachem b'nei Adoni. He says, why? Let me find favor in the eyes of my master. I don't want to push you to do all these things. Vayosha b'yom ahu Esav l'darko se'ira, and Esav says, fine. Esav goes back to, goes to Seir. That's where it stops. Now, there are a lot of questions we could ask regarding this story. We could be here all day doing questions on this story.
Why doesn't he do some carrots?
Right, there's no sense of outreach at all to Esav. He's not trying to get Esav to become like him, it appears. That's correct. I want to make sure to hit certain questions because we're already almost half an hour in and I haven't gone to anywhere. Oh, that's interesting. I think the usual way that we take it, though, is that I will go min ha'amashariti, leaving from the nation that is with me. It can be, but latzi can also be to go forward. You're right, like in Vayatzeget HaMaklot Asher Pitzel, in the story with the sticks that go in the troughs, right, he put them forth. But I still think Atzi Gana is usually taken as ace of offering. Even taking it your way, I think Esav is still going to be with him. Even taking it with that approach, it's an interesting point. I don't deny that the Vayatzeg and Atziga can be taken that way. The questions that I want to focus on here are, number one, is Esav sincere? Is Esav sincere when he falls on his throat, when he kisses him, when they cry? is Esav actually looking to make up with Yaakov? That's one question. Another question is, why does Yaakov obsequiously, really, insist on him taking the gift? Because if he's saying, you know, now we're equals, now that you took my gift, I'm not clear on all the my masters that follow it up. And then, why does Yaakov reject Esav's offer of accompaniment? And by the way, when he says, now it's got to be me, I'm sorry. I would prefer discussion, but it's a matter of time. Along with this, Yaakov said, don't worry, I'm going to come meet you in Seir. Seir is in fact in the land of Edom, where Esav ends up. He says, I'm going to meet you in Seir. We have no record of Yaakov going to Seir at all. So what happened in that? What happened on that level? So to try to address this a little bit, first of all, the general trend in the commentaries is to suggest that Esav was sincere. There is an alternative view because we're Jews, and there's always an alternative view. But the general trend is to assume Esav was sincere. If you take a look at source number 3, the Midrash produces both views. The word in the Hebrew for the kiss that they exchanged is vayishakehu. And if you look in a Torah scroll, you will find dots over that word. And dots in the ancient Near East were a means of scribal notation, telling you something is up here. And the question is what? So the Midrash says, vayishakehu, and he kissed him, nakud alav. There are dots on top of it. Shalo nishakehu b'chol libo. That he didn't kiss him with a whole heart. Esav kissed him, but it wasn't with a whole heart. That's the first view. Second view, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said, Halacha biyadua. It is established halacha. It has the force of law. She Esav sone li Yaakov. That Esav hates Yaakov. He says, make no mistake about it. Ella, but, Nevchu rachma ba'osa shah unshako b'cholibo. His mercies were reversed at that moment, and he kissed Yaakov with all of his heart. Esav was, according to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, sincere. Now, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai has no love for the descendants of Esav. Remember the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, right? He criticizes the Roman government, and the Romans were classically linked with Esav. They were considered to be the descendants of Esav. He criticized the Roman government. Someone squealed and told the Romans about what this Jewish leader had said. They came after him to kill him. He was tipped off, and he had to hide in a cave for what ended up being 13 years to avoid getting killed by the Romans until the Caesar died. He had to hide out in a cave. He has no great love for them. But he says Esav was sincere. If you take a look on the flip side of the sheet, it's source number 4. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, writing in Spain in the 12th century, 11th into the 12th, says, Hadrash al nekudos vayishakehu, tov hu la'atike mishadayim. He says, yeah, that idea about the dots on vayishakehu, meaning that Esav wasn't really sincere, he says that's good for those who are recently weaned. Ibn Ezra does not mince words. When he disagrees with something, he tells you. So he says, that's a nice lesson for children. He says, on a literal level, Esav does not plan to harm his brother. And he says, I'll prove it to you. It says, and they cried, Kasher asa Yosef im Echav, just as Yosef did with his brothers. Right? A generation later, Joseph is sold by his brothers. Eventually they meet up again, and they cry together, and we understand that that was a sincere cry. The same word is used here, the crying is sincere. That's Ibn Ezra's understanding. We move forward in Jewish history to more recent times. Rabbi Yehuda Leibush Malbim, writing in the 19th century, I didn't bring it on the sheet just for lack of space, but he says, God turned Esav's heart, Esav was sincere. The Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, head of the yeshiva in Volozhin at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, he says, both of them cried, Esav was awakened to recognize Yaakov as his brother and to love his brother, and Yaakov was awakened in return, it was sincere. The trend among many commentators is to say, Esav in fact is approaching Yaakov warmly. Okay, that's number one. Well, then why does Yaakov insist that he take the gift? Why does Yaakov keep calling him my master? Take a look at source number 5. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah gives advice. This is advice to the Jew living in Roman times. Shalo lehechan holech. If you happen to be traveling on the road, and someone who is some Roman is traveling with you, and he asks you, so where are you headed? Yarchiv loes haderech. Kederech sha'ase Yaakov avinu le'esav harasha. He should literally extend the route, as Yaakov did with Esav. Meaning, let's say I was traveling on a bus, or I was taking the subway, and I'm heading downtown, and I'm really planning on going to, I'm planning on going to Bloor. Guy next to me asks me, how far are you going? I should say Union. Right? I'm heading south, so further than that I actually am. The idea being, that way he's going to think that he has more time to attack me, and then when I get off earlier, I will have saved my life. The message of this passage is, be suspicious. Don't leave yourself open. Right? The same way that I was always warned that if you call a cab to take you to the airport, right? So you shouldn't give them your address. You should tell them instead, like, the next house down or somewhere else, because otherwise they're going to know that no one's at home. You've heard that before? No? It's good advice. See that? You came here, you got good advice. But the message is one of suspicion. And he says, as Yaakov did to Esav, just like Yaakov did with Esav, he said, I'm going to go to Seir. He was never planning on going to Seir. But he figured that way Esav is going to think he has more time to attack him. Yes, quickly.
Did the commentators say how many people were in the band of Yaakov? They very clearly specified that it was 400 in Esav's band. But what about Yaakov? And I think this is back with the images.
Yeah. The answer is no, we don't have a number. We know Yaakov's family, and we know that there are others there because there are others who bring the gift to Esav. But we're not told how many there are. I think it's safe to assume that they're outnumbered. Yeah. So Yaakov refuses to travel with Esav, but first he insists that Esav take the gift because he is worried. He's worried that Esav is going to do something to him. Despite Esav's sincerity, Yaakov is still nervous. And then he refuses to travel with Esav. Worth noting, the commentators differ on whether Yaakov actually lied here. Meaning, there is the view that we just saw in source number 5 that he lies about his destination. Then there's a view in the Medrash that he's not really lying because we're taught that in the time of Mashiach, in the times of the Messiah, Yaakov is going to meet up with Esav at Mount Seir. So he's saying, eventually I'm getting to Seir. Then there's another view from the Malbim, Rabbi Yehuda Leibush Malbim, who says, no, he wasn't lying. But if you look at the story, what happens is Esav doesn't go to Seir either. Esav instead goes to Yitzchak, as seen in Bereishit in chapter 35. Esav, in fact, goes to Yitzchak. And so when Yaakov goes back to his father's house, he meets him there. We don't get that encounter recorded in the Torah, but that's why he doesn't go to Seir. He would have really made good on his word. Yaakov is not a liar. But it never comes up, because they end up meeting at Yitzchak's house. That's just an interesting side note. But the bottom line is, what emerges for me here, if I were to stop with this and say, Ad Khan, here we go, those are our sources, I would assume that the lesson is, be very suspicious, no matter how sincere they are, and be obsequious. Bow as often as you can. Make sure you say, my master, as often as you can, in order to keep them happy. Right? That's the lesson. No? That's what you're seeing here. Whether that's what we do or not, that's what emerges. As a matter of fact, the Medrash does quote it. If you go back now to source number 1, Esav said to him, I will go forth with you. We comment on that Rebbe, our master, Rabbeinu, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, wasn't supposed to take anybody with him when he went to Rome. If you take a look at source number 6, comment from Ramban, Nachmanides, writing in 13th century Spain, a time when he certainly knew of oppression. He was the one, you will recall, in the year 1263, who was forced by the government to debate with Pablo Cristiani, the Jew who had converted to Christianity. And the normal penalties for such debates were, if you lost, the Jewish population was forced to convert or be expelled. And if you won, so you were expelled. That was the that was what went on in those debates. No, that's not a joke. That was true. That's history. So much so that Ramban, Nachmanides, goes to James of Aragon, the king of that province. In those days, it's provinces. And he says to him, I will only participate in the debate if you guarantee that I won't be exiled when I win. And in fact, James is good to his word until there's pressure from the Pope. It also has to do with Nachmanides producing an account for public consumption of the debate, making Pablo Christiani look not so good. And the result is that he's expelled, I think, 5 years later. You didn't do well in these debates. It didn't matter what was going to happen. So Nachmanides is writing from knowledge about the Jew dealing with Esav. And he says in source number 6, V'yeshba od remez ledoros. He says, in this story of the encounter, there's another hint for generations. Ki kol asher ima la'avinu am Esav achiv, everything that happened to our father, Yaakov, with his brother Esav, yera lanu tamidim b'nei Esav, will always happen to us with the children of Esav. V'roi lanu lechos b'darko shel tzadik. We should act in the manner of the righteous one, Yaakov. We should make the same three preparatory steps that our ancestor Yaakov did. Letfila, prayer. Ula doron, a gift. Ula hatzala bederech milchama, and to rescue via war. Livroach ulihinatzel, to flee and to be saved. Interesting to note his definition of war. Right? To be saved via war by fleeing. Right, we will put up enough weapons that they won't be able to catch us when we run away. That's the third point from Ramban. As a matter of fact, this is recorded as halachic advice, as advice of Jewish law. The passage there in that Gemara, in source number 5, continues to talk about fears even of going to a doctor who is not Jewish, lest he take advantage of your vulnerability to attack you. I mean, there, ad kidei kach, to that point, there was really such a fear of dealing with them. The Mishnah Halachas, Rabbi Nasha Klein, talks about using this in our own day. Trying to use this as an example of what a Jew should do. But now I have a problem. Because what we've said so far is that Yaakov presents this model of obsequiousness, this model of suspicion, and we are supposed to emulate it. Well, not so fast, because take a look at source number 7, please. In source number 7, the Medrash says, I'm going to make a long story short in the interests of time, at the end of this coming week's Torah portion, we are going to read that Esav had 8 kings before there was a king in Israel. That's what the biblical verse says. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom. Edom being Esav. Before a king reigned for Israel. So the Medrash picks up on that. Why do you need to say he had 8 kings before we did? If you want to record his kings, record his kings. What's with the comparison? Says this Medrash in source number 7, when Yaakov called Esav my master, God said to him, you lowered yourself. And you called Esav my master 8 times. God swears, by your life, Yaakov, I will establish 8 kings from his descendants before yours. As it is written, and it goes on to quote the verses. Is Yaakov suddenly right for bowing and calling him my master, or is he wrong?
No.
He's wrong. Now suddenly we don't like what Yaakov did. As a matter of fact, very similarly, there's a medrash on Megillat Esther. If you remember the Purim story, Haman gets angry when what? What happens to get Haman angry? Mordechai won't bow to him. So the Medrash has this great read there, because Mordechai is considered to be, on the one hand, a descendant of the tribe of Judah, but on the other hand, a descendant of the tribe of Binyamin, of Benjamin. He's known as the Yemini. Mordechai says, I can't bow to Haman because my grandfather didn't bow to his grandfather. Because my grandfather was Binyamin, who had not been born yet when everybody bowed to Esav. His grandfather, great-great-grandfather, Binyamin, was the 12th son who wasn't alive at this stage. So he says, my grandfather didn't bow to Haman's grandfather, Esav, so I'm not going to bow to Haman. But point being not, this is a nice writer about Purim, although it's always good to think about Purim. But my point is, there's a statement there that the bowing was wrong. I don't bow. Mordechai doesn't bow. So how am I supposed to understand the criticism of what Yaakov did? What Yaakov did fundamentally was the peace of surrender. That's really what it comes down to. Give him a gift, call him your master, and let me go on my way. That's the peace of surrender. And suddenly we're getting criticism of it. So I wanted, if this were a perfect world and we existed in a vacuum, I would now open it for discussion and we could come to an idea ourselves and probably come to multiple ideas. And I would actually love to do that. But in the interest of time, I'm going to offer one idea. Rabbi David Cohn notes something fascinating in the comment of Nachmanides. Source number 8. Rabbi David Cohn is a rabbi in Brooklyn. He wrote a work called Maaseh Avot Siman LeBanim. One of the things I want to email out, so please make sure that you sign up with your email address, is a link to where you can find his full article online. So if you sign up, you'll get that.
Unusual name. Is he Jewish?
Yes, actually. Good point. He says, well, if Fionius Daiti, he says, in my humble opinion, we may detect this, what the issue is, in Ramban's golden tongue. You see, Ramban Nachmanides continues regarding this point to say, Shahaisa Kabbalah biyadam shezu parshas galus. Nachmanides says that Jews would study this story of Yaakov and Esav to know how to deal with the Romans. Why? Because they had a tradition that this is the portion of exile. This teaches the Jew how to behave in exile. Continuing, I'm just going to read from the English in the interest of time. Apparently, we should learn from our ancestor Yaakov's conduct, but our sages criticized him for doing this in
Israel.
Yaakov's not in exile anymore. Yaakov had been in exile when he was with his brother-in-law, or his father-in-law, Lavan. Right? Then he came back. He met Esav over the border. He met Esav in Israel. What Yaakov did was fine and proper for the Jew who's living in someone else's land. But when you're in your own land, your conduct has to change. Not that you no longer pursue peace, but you pursue peace differently. And that, he says, is the mistake. The sages criticized him for doing this in Israel, when one should not act in the ways of exile. The gift and prayer, he says, are explicit in the verses. When it talks about Yaakov's preparations, it tells us explicitly about the gift. It tells us explicitly about his prayer to God. But his preparations for war are only implied, and they're implied in the words, "The remaining camp will flee," indicating the goal of war is to fight so that the remaining camp will flee. The goal of our ancestor Yaakov was to save what he could, until we could reach the end of days, a messianic time, and the fulfillment of the rescuers will ascend Mount Zion to judge Mount Esav. He had a tradition that throughout the days of exile, one should be humble before Esav. That's the way Rav Cohn explains what Yaakov was doing. Yaakov was trying to survive. That was what he was going for. He was not going for any form of victory. He was not going for any form of recognition. There was no equality. He simply wanted to make it to the next day. Similarly, Nachmanides actually sees this in a later story. Remember the story after this one, biblically? What's the next story in the Torah after this one? Who remembers? Shechem. Exactly. In the city of Shechem, Yaakov's daughter Dinah is raped. And Yaakov and his sons end up coming to her rescue, sort of, but with different ideas. Yaakov knows of the plan. Shimon and Levi arrange for the city to be vulnerable. I'm not going to go into the whole story now, but Shimon and Levi arrange for the city to be vulnerable, and then they go in and they level the city. Yaakov is in on the plan, but he disapproves of the way they do it. He wants to go in and get Dinah out. They fight a war. And there's a dispute between the two of them, between Shimon and Levi on the one end, and Yaakov afterwards. And Shimon and Levi say, you can't let them do that to your daughter. You can't let them do that to our sister. And Yaakov says, now we're going to have to fight wars against all of them. against all of these different people around us, it's a fundamental approach that Yaakov has that Shimon and Levi disagree with. And taking that now and applying it for us, the message is, the message that I see here is that at a certain point in our history, we need to transition from the peace of surrender to the peace of equals. It's not that we stop pursuing peace, but we stop pursuing peace by saying, please, we'll give you whatever you want. That's the transition. And it occurs when he crosses the border into Israel. That was when it was supposed to take place. So to sum up what we've seen before, one final note. But to sum up what we've seen so far, we saw the initial story of the encounter. We saw the way that Yaakov insists, Esav, please take my gifts. We saw the way Esav embraces him and refuses the gifts. We saw as well the comments in the Medrash that say that Yaakov indeed was suspicious of Esav, despite Esav's apparent sincerity. Yaakov is suspicious. He holds Esav up as master. We saw that through history, Jews did learn from Esav what they were supposed to do. But we saw that Yaakov gets criticized. And Rabbi David Cohen explains that the criticism is because there's a point where you stop. When you get into the land of Israel, you no longer act in that manner. You pursue peace differently. One last point on this. Ramban, Nachmanides, invoked a principle called Maasei Avot Siman Labanim. The deeds of our ancestors are a sign for our descendants. He invoked that as a prescription. What our ancestors did, our children should also do. However, it's also taken as a description. That which our ancestors went through, we are going to need to go through as well. And Ramban Nachmanides saw that in Yaakov's actions. Nachmanides said if you take a look in source number 10, he quotes the Medrash. One who grips the ears of a dog enters a fight which is not his own. That's a passage from the book of Mishlei, of Proverbs, right? Meaning, Yaakov is, in a way, responsible for this whole mess. Because Yaakov goes to Esav initially. When Yaakov comes back into the land, he sends messengers to Esav. He didn't need to go looking for a fight, so to speak, by going to him. So the Medrash says, you grip the ears of a dog, you enter a fight which is not your own. The dog would have left you alone. God said to him, he was going on his way. You sent to him, so says your servant Yaakov. The way Nachmanides understands that is not only is he saying you proactively went looking for trouble with Esav, but you called yourself the servant. In my view, he said, this also hints that we begin our own fall into the hand of Edom of Rome. For the kings of the Second Temple made a pact with the Romans, some of them going to Rome. This caused their fall into the hands of Rome. And we see this in Jewish history. We have brought our own troubles upon ourselves in the way that we approached our neighbors. It was true in Greek times. There were fights about the succession of the high priesthood when the Jews were living under the Greeks. And the result was that the different sides went to the Greeks for support. And the Greeks used that as an opportunity to strengthen their hold. Agrippus, at the end of the Second Temple time, goes to the Romans to get support. And the Romans end up turning the Jews into a tribute state. It's happened to us over and over again. It happened to us biblically. The brothers sell Joseph down to Egypt. And the result is they all end up down there in Egypt. Nachmanides notes this happens over and over again in Jewish history. It's a problem that we continue to see. And our challenge, now that we are back in the land of Israel, the Jew here in Canada is in Canada, I get that. But our nation is back in Israel, we have the land. The challenge for us is to reverse this product of our exile. To reverse what Nachmanides identified among his descendants, among the descendants of Yaakov, this pursuit of peace in an obsequious way. Not that there should be no pursuit of peace, God forbid. We are taught in our tradition that we absolutely must pursue peace and live stably in a proper society alongside others. However, not the pursuit of, not the peace of surrender, but instead the peace of equals. I skipped source number 9. It's an interesting source in its own right. I apologize. I'm going to stick around afterwards, but I want to make sure that people have the opportunity to sefer katamazon, to thank God for the food, and then to leave as they need to. But I'm going to stick around to be able to discuss this further. And again, if you haven't signed up with your email address, please make sure that you do so. Again, I want to thank the Kaufman family for doing this. And the learning that we did today should provide merit for Avraham ben Nissan.